To his testimony, Fitzgerald and I, along with FBI agents, flew to Rome to interview him. As we ate homemade pasta prepared for us by this professional killer, Mutolo laid out his life as a Cosa Nostra man of honor. I wish I could say I felt something different when I was in the presence of a mass murderer, handing me a cup of espresso in an empty convent. In the movies, some foreboding music might play in the background or the light might dim. But there was none of that. Evil has an ordinary face. It laughs, it cries, it deflects, it rationalizes, it makes great pasta. These killers were people who had crossed an indelible line in human experience by intentionally taking another life. They all constructed their own narrative to explain and justify their killing. None of them saw themselves as bad people. To a person, they all said the same thing. The first time was really, really hard. After that, not so much. Mutolo had killed so many people that he couldn't remember them all. After naming nearly 30, he added that we should assume there were 7 or 8 more. At one point, he recalled killing a man named Galatolo. Then he recalled hitting another man named Galatolo with a meat cleaver, but the man had not died. On the witness stand, he remembered that he had actually killed yet another man named Galatolo, making it 2 Galatolos killed and 1 Galatolo merely hit in the chest with a meat cleaver. During the day, I was in court as Mutolo testified, spilling the secrets of the mafia's reign of death and crime, while my evenings were spent meeting with Sammy the Bull Gravano in a safe house controlled by the United States Marshals Service. Gravano had previously testified in Brooklyn federal court against family boss John Gotti, where defense lawyers made much of his involvement in 19 homicides. Sammy the Bull didn't know it, but part of our strategy was to present the mob killers in such a way that the jury would actually be bored with the details of mob murders by the time Gravano, our star witness, hit the stand. Our hope was that this would make Gravano more palatable to the jury. Gravano, though, saw this as a bit of professional embarrassment. One evening I walked into a safe house conference room. Gravano threw a New York tabloid onto the table before me with a look of disgust. He'd been reading an article about the grim body count of our Sicilian killer witnesses, which was far higher than his own. Pointing at the paper, Gravano barked, "Jesus, Jimmy, you're making me look like a fucking schoolgirl." Thanks to the work of dozens of investigators and prosecutors, La Cosa Nostra's grip on unions was broken, its leaders jailed, and its dominance on both sides of the Atlantic shattered. John Gambino's trial jury actually hung 11-1 on all the most serious charges in suspicious circumstances, but he pled guilty before his retrial, was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison, and has since died. There are still people in New York who call themselves Italian Mafia, but it's a motley collection of low-level criminals that would embarrass Lucky Luciano. It more closely resembles The Sopranos without the therapist. Chapter 3. The Bully. Courage is fire, and bullying is smoke. Benjamin Disraeli. Mafia members may dress and talk in distinctive ways, but they're part of a fairly common species, the bully. All bullies are largely the same. They threaten the weak to feed some insecurity that rages inside them. I know. I've seen it up close. When people see me, their first reaction is always to make note of my height. At 6'8", I'm hard to miss. But when I was a kid, I was anything but imposing. In fact, when my parents moved us from Yonkers, New York to Allendale, New Jersey, I was in the 5th grade and quickly went from being a popular kid to being a popular target for bullies. From birth, I had lived in a modest house packed together with other modest houses in Yonkers. Nearly all of my relatives were from Yonkers, a blue-collar city on the northern edge of the Bronx, one of the 5 boroughs of New York City. My great-grandparents were part of a wave of Irish immigration to the area in the late 1800s. My mother and father grew up blocks from each other on The Hill, an Irish enclave in the northwest part of the city. My grandfather dropped out of school in the 6th grade to go to work to support his family after his father was killed in an industrial accident. He later became a police officer and rose to lead the Yonkers Police Department. Our home was immediately behind Public School 16, the school where I happily spent my early childhood years. My mother had attended PS 16, One of my grandmother's best friends was the principal. And by the time we moved, I was one of the most popular kids in my fifth grade class. Yonkers and School 16 were the center of my world. I could see the big red brick school through the tall chain-link fence separating my backyard from the school playground. My older sister, two younger brothers, and I would walk to school every day, circling the block, because the fence was too tall to climb. I knew everybody, and as far as I knew, everybody thought I was a pretty cool fifth grader. I fit in. I felt like I belonged somewhere. That was a great feeling. But it ended when my dad brought us news that changed my life. My father, Brian Comey, worked for a big oil company. He started out selling cans of motor oil to gas station operators and moved up to finding locations for new stations. For decades afterward, he could drive around the New York metropolitan area and show you the corners he spotted, his gas stations. In the 1960s, both the car business and the gas business were booming. When my dad took a new job with a company in northern New Jersey in 1971, it meant we had to move to a place that, until then, had existed in my mind only as tall cliffs called the Palisades. Yonkers sits on the eastern bank of the mile-wide Hudson River. In the spaces between the houses on my street, I could see the Palisades forming a dark stone wall on the western bank. I don't think I ever believed the world ended at that formidable wall, because we had driven to Indiana once, but it might as well have. We were moving to the other side of the wall, where a new world awaited the coolest kid in the fifth grade at School 16. I was not the coolest kid at my new school, Brookside Elementary in Allendale, New Jersey, something I figured out pretty quickly. My parents were always trying to save money, so my mother cut her boy's hair with her own electric clippers and dressed us in clothes she purchased at a Sears outlet. My pants were too short, and I wore white socks and heavy-soled black shoes to support the fallen arches in my huge feet. I didn't know it, but it turns out I had a New York accent different from the kids in Allendale. I stuck out like a sore thumb. The soreness quickly became more than metaphorical. One of my first days on the fifth grade playground, I was surrounded by a group of boys who taunted me in my looks. I don't remember what I said to them, but I probably said something, because I was a confident kid with a big mouth, even though I was not tough enough to back up what I said. They knocked me to the ground. The bullies regularly invited their victims to fistfights staged after school in a nearby park. I was called out numerous times but never showed up, walking well out of my way to avoid the park. I remember one time attempting to reason with one of the bullies when he said he wanted to fight me. "If you don't like me, and I don't like you, and then we punch each other in the head